From MainePublic.org, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, October 21st, 2016. And on this day, Portland landlord Gregory Nisbet is acquitted on 6 counts of manslaughter in connection with the deaths of 6 people killed in a fire 2 years ago. We've heard a lot about the 5 referendum questions on Maine's November ballot, but there's also a question 6. We'll tell you about that. And a unique program helps smooth the ride for students with developmental disabilities who are on the road to independence. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs.
I'm Barbara Caridi. Portland landlord Gregory Nisbet has been acquitted of manslaughter in the deaths of 6 people who died in a fire at his Noyes Street property 2 years ago. Nisbet was also cleared of all misdemeanor code violations except for one. Though the verdict is a disappointment to families and prosecutors, some hope that the case will increase building safety in the future. Patty White reports.
For Gregory Nisbet to be found guilty of manslaughter, prosecutors had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that his negligence caused the deaths of the 6 young adults who perished at his property after a discarded cigarette butt on the front porch ignited a fire on November 1, 2014. Superior Court Justice Thomas Warren explained in his verdict that while he did not find Nisbet entirely blameless,
the court cannot find that it is almost certainly true that the deceased occupants would have been able to survive if there had been no conduct by defendant that could be found to be either reckless or criminally negligent.
During the trial, prosecutors argued that Nisbet's Noyes Street property was a death trap, with inoperable smoke alarms, a blocked stairwell, and third-floor windows that were too small to provide a secondary exit. They also argued that the duplex classified not as a single-family dwelling, but as a rooming house, which has to meet higher safety standards. Justice Warren disagreed.
Under the fire code as it applies in Portland, a group of friends or acquaintances can rent a dwelling unit together and be considered to be a family, allowing the dwelling unit to continue to qualify as a one-family dwelling.
Justice Warren did, however, find Nisbet guilty on one misdemeanor code violation for the third-floor windows that were too small. But that was of little consolation to friends and family, some of whom walked out while Justice Warren read his verdict. Outside the courtroom, friends and family called the verdict ridiculous, but declined reporters' requests for comment. Prosecuting attorney Bud Ellis, an assistant DA, says he's disappointed but hopes that the trial will at least result in improved safety.
I'm utterly convinced this isn't the only building around that does not satisfy the safety code, and our ardent hope is that a lot more is done as a result of this, so this kind of tragedy doesn't happen again.
Nisbet's attorney Matthew Nichols says he's already witnessed a shift from the sheer volume of phone calls he's received from landlords ever since the fire occurred 2 years ago.
If this case, this prosecution, has not at least had the effect of having every single landlord re-examine their policies and practices, I don't know what will.
Britt Vitalius, the president of the Southern Maine Landlord Association, agrees that the trial, which would have set a precedent in Maine if Nisbet had been found criminally guilty of manslaughter, has pushed safety to the top of landlords' minds.
These charges are a terrifying wake-up call for landlords to contemplate going to jail for 30 years.
Portland Mayor Ethan Strimling and City Manager John Jennings expressed their condolences to families in a written statement. Jennings says safety is a top priority for the city and that the Office of Housing Safety, which was created in response to the fire, has registered more than 18,000 rental units, proactively inspected more than 800 properties, and investigated approximately 150 complaints. Nisbet, who will have a sentencing hearing scheduled in the coming weeks, faces up to 180 days in jail and a $1,000 fine for the misdemeanor charge. But his attorney, Matthew Nichols, says the trial will have a lasting effect on his client.
Nothing is gonna alleviate the tragic nature of this and the pain and sorrow that Greg Nisbet is feeling. That's going to be with him for the rest of his life.
Nisbet is also facing a civil lawsuit filed by victims' families. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
And you may have been hearing a lot in the news about the 5 referenda on the main ballot this November and seen the ads, but there is actually also a question 6 as well. It asks voters to approve borrowing $100 million for transportation projects. Mal Leary has more.
Most of the money from the proposed bond would go for construction and reconstruction of roads and bridges across the state. But there are also allocations for ports, airports, railroads, and bike and pedestrian paths. The proposal is one of the few broadly bipartisan measures passed by lawmakers and supported by Governor Paul LePage. Gorham Democratic State Representative Andrew McLean supports the bond.
If government can't provide safe and efficient infrastructure, what can it do? So people, I think, understand the need for money, for funding, for infrastructure projects.
But McLean, who co-chairs the legislature's Transportation Committee, also believes that it doesn't go far enough. He says the state needs to come up with some additional revenue sources beyond the gas tax in order to avoid borrowing nearly every year to fix the roads. He says even if voters approve Question 6, the state will not have enough money on hand to make all of the needed repairs accumulated because of deferred maintenance.
Every year, the Department of Transportation says that we need roughly $170 million more in funding just to keep up with our basic maintenance. And we're not doing that.
But the Maine DOT did get high marks in a national study released last month. University of North Carolina professor David Hartgen, a Maine native, authored the ranking of all the states for the Reason Foundation. He says the Maine DOT has a national reputation for efficiency and stretching a dollar.
They're working on the problems they know about, but compared with other states, they seem to have their shoulder on the wheel and they're moving forward slowly.
Transportation bonds have traditionally passed with solid margins, but this is a most unusual year in Maine. Both presidential nominees have high negative ratings, and there are 5 controversial referenda ahead of the bond. Polling indicates that many potential voters are turned off by this year's campaigns and may not vote at all. But others who don't usually vote may show up this year. Political scientists say all those factors will likely result in some surprises on Election Day. University of Maine political science professor Mark Brewer.
That being said, I would be very surprised if the electorate is different in such a way that puts a general kind of infrastructure bond at risk. I mean, that's not to say that it couldn't happen, but I'd be surprised if it does.
The $100 million bond, if approved, will allow the state to draw down about $137 million from other sources, mostly from federal transportation appropriations. Projects funded by the bond will be completed over the next couple of years. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
And a Maine group that promotes bicycling says it's noticed an uptick in the number of fatal crashes between automobiles and bikes and pedestrians in recent weeks. 3 people have been killed in separate incidents since October 10th, bringing the total of fatalities so far this year to 11, on pace with last year. The Maine Bicycle Coalition's James Tassie says dangerous road design, distracted driving, and bikers and walkers not paying attention all play a role.
There are a lot of factors at play, and it just goes to show that our roads are dangerous places where people need to really be doing the best they can to look out for others in all situations.
Tassie says the coming months, as daylight fades, historically show the biggest upswing in bike and pedestrian fatalities. Coming up, providing specialized training for students with developmental disabilities to help them reach their goal of independence. A survey done for Colby College and the Boston Globe shows a growing bipartisan desire for compromise on political issues. Dan Shea, a professor of government at Colby's Goldfarb Center, says the most recent poll results show a shift in attitudes over the past 6 years.
Spring of 2010, very few strong conservatives and Republicans wanted to compromise. I think that they thought they were going to win the midterm election, which of course they did, and they sort of stuck with that for a while. Now that's changed.
The poll, done by Survey USA, is based on interviews with 1,000 adults nationwide. 2 out of 3 voters said it was more important for a politician to compromise than to stand firm on a set of beliefs. 82% of those polled said elected officials should try to be friends with members of the other party. And for special education students, attitudes and expectations are changing. Barriers to employment, independent living, and even college are being lowered. But there is a need for more specialized training for students with developmental disabilities, especially toward the end of high school. And as Susan Sharon reports, a unique year-round program is helping to fill that void.
Oh, look, what is that?
24.
Oh, not our bus.
Oh, man.
So that one's the South Portland bus. We're looking for the Metro. Okay? Should be here in a minute.
It's a weekday morning, and Kelly Fry is taking a group of students on a field trip to Hadlock Field in Portland. Fry is a specialist with TOPS, Transition Outcome Program for Students. It's designed to help developmentally disabled students in their 5th and 6th years of high school prepare for post-graduation occupations and make the leap to life on their own. Today, the real focus of the field trip is to teach them to ride the bus.
Excuse me, but who are you?
My name's Susan. I'm on Maine Public Radio. I'm a reporter. I'm following you guys today on the bus.
Nice.
Is that okay?
Yes, nice.
Thatcher is a student at Cape Elizabeth who says he's excited about his upcoming 20th birthday and about a special project he has in the works.
I made a video for Tom Cruise, so I might get to see him soon. I'm really excited. He is busy, but I know he won't forget. He won't forget about seeing me.
Under Maine special ed regulations, students like Thatcher can stay in public school if they're not more than 20 years old and haven't met their graduation requirements.
So we have this population of students who are really accessing 2 additional years of high school many times, and we wanted something different for them.
Julie Olson is the director of instructional support for MSAD 51, which serves Cumberland and North Yarmouth. About 3 years ago, she says, several special ed directors started talking about ways they could give students some additional life skills training beyond the classroom.
They had done 4 years of high school. They had accessed really good programming in their district, but they really needed a focus on transition planning and bridging that gap from high school to adult services or college and career readiness in some way. And we wanted to build their community as well.
Meaning their community of peers. So last fall, they partnered with Strive, a South Portland-based agency that provides peer support, education, and training to tweens, teens, and young adults with intellectual and emotional disabilities. This year, there are 12 school districts participating in the TOPS program. Some students come as many as 5 days a week. Strive's Associate Director Pete Brown says it's important for students to learn to be as independent as possible.
Many of these students may have had an ed tech, education technician with them all day, every day, from throughout their whole school career. And our goal is to try to fade that support so students can be more successful and be more prepared for adult services.
Students work with vocational rehabilitation to explore different opportunities. They take classes in cooking and following recipes, sewing and managing money. The idea is to build confidence and raise their aspirations. Bridget has been practicing making a list and going to the grocery store.
So have you done that by yourself yet?
I tried it once, but it was too scary.
Oh, what was scary about it?
I accidentally got the wrong thing, and so I had to do it again.
You mean you got the wrong item at the grocery store? Something that you didn't really need?
Right. I was with Kelly at that time.
Students often need prodding and gentle reinforcement, but they do have dreams and they are setting goals. Bridget says she thinks about living with a roommate in her own house in Scarborough. And for parents like Lisa Bell of Dayton, steering students toward these kinds of ideas is encouraging. Bell's daughter Emily attends TOPS and has an internship with a health clinic through her public school.
She has some definite goals and objectives when it comes to work. So she loves anything to do with science and animals and biology. For example, the Life Flight helicopter, she thinks that is probably the best job ever, or working for the CDC.
Bell says she recognizes that her daughter has been fortunate to have gotten strong support in school and at Strive through programs like TOPS. And she's come to believe that Emily can do much more than she originally thought possible. Pete Brown of Strive is hopeful that TOPS can spread to other communities in Maine. It will, he says, continue to break down the biggest barrier for students like Emily and Thatcher and Bridget and Cole, the prejudice of low expectations.
We're going to the bus now?
We are, yes.
To the bus we go.
For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
And as autumn produce starts hitting the shelves, Maine's cranberry harvest appears to be strong, despite fears over drought conditions.
Might even prove to be a little bit above average size yield this year.
Charles Armstrong is a cranberry expert with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. He says growers across the state have had to irrigate crops to stay ahead of the drought, but he says some growers are reporting their largest yields ever, with good fruit size and weight, a relief in a market that's struggled in recent years.
Because the price has been depressed for a number of years now, but I think we've seen the bottom of that, and there are already some rumors that the price is going to start going up again.
Last year, Maine lost its biggest cranberry grower, Cherryfield Foods, and several other growers declined to harvest because of low prices. Maine will harvest up to 1.5 million pounds of cranberries this year. And while Maine is getting some much-needed rain today and tomorrow, it's not going to make a big difference in the drought. Nearly 70% of Maine is now in a drought that's affecting about 1.2 million people. Of those, many who use shallow dug wells for their water supply are finding those wells drying up. That's especially true in southern Maine, where the drought is worse. National Weather Service hydrologist Tom Hawley says that the 1 to 2.5 inches of rain expected between now and Sunday morning aren't going to provide the kind of groundwater replenishment those wells would need.
Places that get 2.5 inches may see some response in the groundwater, but it takes a lot longer for the groundwater to respond than it does for surface water. Of course, the rivers will see a pretty quick response. Groundwater may take several days to several weeks before you'll see a response in the groundwater.
Hawley says after this, the weather will likely turn dry again, and he says it will take several months of higher than normal precipitation to end the drought, and that doesn't seem to be in the cards. And with more on the weather, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins.
This will be the most substantial rainstorm for the entire state since July. Heavy rain will blossom statewide tonight, quite foggy, but temperatures will remain nearly steady. Tomorrow will be remarkably mild as the deep storm churns through western Maine. Southern sections cloudy, with a low risk of a shower, fog lifting. Rain and fog throughout the remainder of the state will taper to showers during the morning from central to north. Temperatures remain in the 50s in the mountains, but rise into the 60s for most. A very windy Sunday is in the cards as the pattern shift gains traction. Considerable cloudiness for most, with isolated showers north, showers and flurries over the mountains, 40s but 50s for much of the state. Some improvement will be enjoyed Lewiston, Auburn, Fryeburg south with sunny intervals, countered by those penetrating gusts. A second cold front will slice through Maine Sunday, variable cloudiness for all, brightest along the coast, a few mountain flurries. Still quite windy, low 40s in the mountains to low 50s Portland south. Tuesday, flurries continue north of mountains, limited sun for the rest of the state and still windy, 40 to 50 north to south. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public.
And that's the news on this day in Maine, Friday, October 21st, 2016. Robert Holt composed our theme music. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Patty White, Mal Leary, Jennifer Mitchell, Erwin Gratz, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mainepublic.org. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public, thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.